That's the great Ray Barreto. Ray Barreto, master percussionist, composer, band leader, and musicologist with Power, the title track of his 1970 album, Barreto Power. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we are continuing our week-long discussion on the Clinton Foundation and its labyrinth of related entities. Whistleblower Charles Ortel's investigations into the operations of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation and its global network of affiliated philanthropic organizations have led him to a startling conclusion. The foundation has engaged in and continues to engage in massive fraud and illegal conduct. Since May, Ortel has been spelling out in great detail how a project chartered originally to build a presidential library and research facility in Arkansas, President Clinton's home state, illegally was morphed into a global philanthropic conglomerate that raked in billions of dollars, ostensibly to support the foundation's charity work. But Ortel says the evidence clearly shows the foundation was operating almost all of its projects illegally, and many major donations to it were from foreign governments and well-placed corporations seeking political favors from the Clintons. The developing world, as it's called, has been and still is a billion-dollar bonanza for the Clintons' coffers, says Ortel. Often besieged by human crises, the international community responds generously to countries in dire need. The Clintons, who keep watchful eyes on countries' misery index, find ingenious ways to corral sizable portions of available humanitarian cash. And that's where we're going today, looking at how the Clinton Foundation has actually targeted these countries and developed elaborate programs around what they identify as an entrepreneurial opportunity. They get a lot of money from the pool of money that the international community allocates to help and to respond to these human crises. But where does the money go? We have talked about this in great detail as it applied to Haiti, where after the massive earthquake in 2010, Bill Clinton found himself essentially the head of the rebuilding effort, having caused the displacement of the Prime Minister of Jamaica, who was elected by the Caribbean countries to head up the effort. Bill Clinton had him kind of knocked out and stepped in as the rebuilder-in-chief. And to this day, Haitians assemble daily in front of the offices of Hillary Clinton, demanding to know, where did $10 billion go? Charles, good to have you with us again today.
Eutrice, it's my great honor.
Well, we are going to go into this issue of how poor nations, nations in distress, nations with millions of people in distress for one reason or another, find themselves desirable candidates for the Clinton Foundation, and how do these countries factor into the money mill of the Clinton Foundation and its various entities?
Well, that's a good question. You know, sadly, in this experience we all share of life. The community of fraudsters is not a small group of people. The community of fraudsters are people who prey upon the innocent, prey upon those who are not cynical enough. Oftentimes they prey upon truly good-hearted people, those who delight in only thinking good about other people. These fraudsters, I doubt there's an organized community of fraudsters, but they seem to all know one another. And when they sense an opportunity to walk off with more ill-gotten gains, they jump into it. And what better opportunity is a gigantic pool of money that has no control over it, that's not responsible to any empowered regulator, that's operated by a team who has demonstrated not over weeks or months or even years, but over decades, a stunning pattern of monetizing supposed government service on the benefit of all of us for their personal benefit. And that would be Team Clinton. Now, I don't want, on this call, I suppose we'll be picking pretty heavily on the Clintons. It's not simply a Democratic problem. The Bushes have allowed themselves to be connected to some of these scandals and other scandals. And I suppose if you went rigorously through this, you'd find many examples on both sides of the aisle, and even people who are not connected to the political process, of this type of thievery. It happened here in New York, sadly, when we had our dreaded September 11th, 2001 moment. Around the world, though New York and Manhattan are very wealthy places, around the world, pocketbooks opened up and money swirled towards Manhattan to try to rebuild the World Trade Center area and care for the people who were so grievously wounded. But wouldn't you know it, that has happened in other great natural disasters, sad natural disasters. People actually decided it would be okay to steal from that recovery fund. So there was an example. I couldn't believe this one. I mean, obviously the New York papers made a big deal that when they found out about it eventually, but there was a case of a woman who claimed that her home had been destroyed. And instead, I think the number, I may have the number modestly off, but directionally close. This woman scammed $1 million to redecorate her Park Avenue condo. And she went right to prison for that. So I think the same thing happened in New Orleans, Mayor Nagy, or however you pronounce that guy's name, in New Orleans, when Katrina happened. I remember people on the radio saying, it's outrageous. The number of police officers, there's a third of the police officers are on the payroll. We can't find, they disappeared. They left New Orleans. They're not helping it up, clean it up. Well, what did the truth turn out to be? The truth turned out to be that a third of the people on the payroll didn't exist. They had been collecting salaries for many years from the city of New Orleans. And there was a massive fraud there. So, what you see with this fraud is that on the one hand, the community of do-gooders, it's a large, vast, wonderful community of people who often, don't have enough money themselves. They should be saving for their own retirements. Now, they hear a tale of woe and they'll send $5 or $20 or $100, whatever it is, over PayPal into one of these pools. And then the fraudsters understand no one's ever really going to check and say, well, did you actually, rebuild India? Did you actually rebuild Haiti? Did you actually get HIV/AIDS medicine to a patient somewhere in the African bush? How can you check that? I mean, particularly if you set up an organization that has no internal controls, it only has trustees nominally attached to it who are all politically and personally dependent upon one family, that is the Clinton. If you use an accounting firm that has been cited for fraud massive many times, when you bring in other accounting firms, you on purpose pick people who are not qualified to go into the African bush, study the peculiarities of the laws in each of these countries to make sure that the foundation is actually authorized for the purpose that it intends to carry out. That's the history here.
So what do you think is the reasoning? How do you think the thinking works and has worked at the Clinton Foundation that it continues to find so much opportunity in areas experiencing so much misery?
Well, I think it's a strange, I guess there's, I love this word, it's a strange mulligatawny stew. You know, I think within the Clinton Foundation, as a guest, there are probably some very good-hearted people who really, truly believe that the organization is, it may be doing good work, and perhaps in some corner of the world they have done some good work. Who knows? But those people are not in charge of putting together the accounting statements and the reports to donors and authorities. That's a different group. There's a man who was installed as chief financial officer back in 2004 named Andrew Kessel. He's still there as chief financial officer. He was plucked for some reason. You look through his background, and there's some missing portions in his background, but he ends up as CFO of the Clinton Foundation just as the construction project is finished. I think that place opened up officially on the 18th of November 2004, and he was installed sometime as March, April 2004. You have a team of do-gooders, you know, who many of these do-gooders are not particularly numerate. You know, they don't understand what accounting statements are supposed to look like. They're volunteers in many cases. And this is precisely why the IRS normally says, if you want to do this, you want to do something internationally, you have to tightly control your international activities from the U.S., which means, you know, you don't just, it's not like the musical The Producers, you know, where you just say you're going to put on a play. I mean, you have to, if you want to operate in a foreign country, you have to respect the laws of every single country. And some countries are Byzantine. I've operated in India. Try figuring out what the law is in India. I mean, it's not easy. There are all sorts of different laws. And you got to comply with all of those. If you need to set up a corporation in India, you have to do that. If you need to set up a charity that's a corporation, you got to do that too. If you have to register with the health department, you better do that. And, you know, when you start checking on the actual realities of the Clinton Foundation, they haven't done anything right. And there is, in accounting, you know, when you go up against fraud, it's not like fraudsters walk in the front door and say, I want to defraud you. They're very subtle. And, you know, some cynics might argue that all politicians are in some ways fraudsters. They promise voters something, and do they ever deliver? Well, who knows? So, you know, you take a political group, a rapacious partisan political group, determined to, you know, hold on to an enhanced power, and you let them close to a foundation that has no controls and that is close to somebody who could become the most powerful person in the world, capable of changing the fortune for the better and for the worse of many people around the world. And you put out a sign saying, I'm for sale. What do you think's going to happen? If you're going to create an international bazaar, spelled both ways, for crooked people who want to be able to brag that they have the President of the United States and American justice, you know, they bought it for what will be for them a modest sum of money. That's what you have here.
But we should keep in mind at all times during our conversations that the Clinton Foundation, with all of this going on, is and has been operating outside of its legal mandate, outside of the law, outside of the purpose for which it said it wanted to establish a foundation, and that was to build a research library, a presidential library and research facility. That's all it was basically permitted to do by law. But then it kind of mushroomed and morphed into all these different, what it actually is, a multi-conglomerate, international conglomerate, operating supposedly in the private, in the philanthropic world, but operating essentially as a business.
Yeah, I mean, I think the value of this, and on balance, I think this thing has done a lot more harm than good. But the value of it, once we get and expose the full story, and once people, you know, lay down their partisan differences and agree that charity fraud is a horrible thing, once we expose the full extent of this, going back to October 23, 1997, to the president, in every country where they raised money, in every country where they operated, in every program they carried out that was illegal, and we could begin to see the facts. This will serve as an amazing cautionary tale, and I think will ensure that charities, American charities in particular, that want to operate abroad, do so properly. So we've talked a bit about HIV/AIDS, and in the last 24 hours, this wonderful person called Michael Smith, who I don't really know that well, but we've been in touch with by email. He's an experienced Australian journalist. He's just provided, and I've shared with you, Therese, information in the desperate country of Papua New Guinea. Now, Papua New Guinea is a long way away from New York, that's for sure. And when you look it up, it is, you know, it's a country that has enormous problems. It has resources, but it doesn't have much infrastructure. It has a long history. It has, sadly, a large population, a proportion of which has HIV/AIDS. And Papua New Guinea was an experiment that obviously went the wrong way and trained the Clintons for Haiti. So what we have there is in 2006, we just got evidence in that Michael managed to get. That in 2006, a lady by the name of Ruby Shang, S-H-A-N-G, held herself out apparently as authorized to open up a subsidiary in Papua New Guinea called the William J. Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS Initiative-PNG in August, I believe, of 2006, or sometime in 2006. She had no legal authorities to do that. But how would the people in Papua New Guinea know that? You're not going to get on a plane and go all the way back to Arkansas and check the files. But the man who provided some backup information, the man I mentioned earlier, Andrew Kessel, provided a notarized copy of the Articles of Incorporation of the Clinton Foundation, omitting crucial documents. These crucial documents would have shown that the Clinton Foundation had created a subsidiary to fight HIV/AIDS on March 24, 2004 in Arkansas and had never received authority either from the IRS to control the entity or from the IRS to have this entity pursue that purpose. And yet they solicited money. There's evidence in Massachusetts that they raised, they put $2 million of Clinton Foundation money into it roughly, and they raised another $4 million. And from people like George Soros and a man called Fred Eichner, and they operated the thing in 2004. And other records show they operated in 2005. And when they couldn't get the authority together that they needed, they thought they came up with a ruse. And that ruse was to say that they'd merged the entity. Now, they hide the merger documents on the Clinton Foundation website, but if you go into the ProPublica website, the nonprofit explorer operated by ProPublica.org, you could get the Clinton Foundation merger agreement for 2005. And it shows quite clearly that had the merger agreement actually been completed, the entity, Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS Initiative, would have been merged out of legal existence. That is to say, it would have been liquidated on December 31st, 2005. So in no way, shape, or form was the Clinton Foundation in Arkansas authorized for this purpose, and specifically to operate an entity in Papua New Guinea, which is, you know, pretty far away from Little Rock. And but the people of Papua New Guinea didn't know that. And the dupes in Australia, the Australian taxpayer, certainly didn't know that this operation was an illegally constructed charity in Papua New Guinea. I don't know the qualifications of Ms. Ruby Chang. Maybe she's an expert on HIV/AIDS. I can't really tell from her LinkedIn profile. But I do notice in her LinkedIn profile she had something to do with a Vietnam Caterpillar distributor formed on, looks to me like around 2004 or 5, when the Clinton Foundation entered Vietnam to do the same sort of thing with Australian money. That's suspicious to me. But anyway, by 2006, Michael produces 10 attachments to Utrecht and to me, and we'll be sharing these publicly through Michael's site, that seem to show that the Australian government sent much more than $10 million towards Papua New Guinea to be used in theory to fight HIV/AIDS. But if you look into news reports about Papua New Guinea and HIV/AIDS, the problem seems to be raging. And there never has been any valid accounting for this money.
And as we discussed yesterday, we do not know about the efficacy of the drugs themselves, because there have been questions about these medications and whether, in fact, they were any good. The manufacturers of a lot of the generic meds that were administered in various programs by the Clinton Foundation as you mentioned yesterday, one was fined and had to pay $500 million for basically producing worthless medications.
Right, exactly. And as I mentioned before, obviously I'm a guy, and less obviously, I'll just admit that I'm very squeamish. And so thinking about health issues is something I don't do all that effectively, but I was able to read enough of this literature on these HIV-AIDS drugs. And these are dangerous drugs. I mean, they do good things. I'm told that, you look at a person, poor guy like Magic Johnson, is found out to be HIV-AIDS positive in the early 1990s, and he's still very much alive and thriving because these antiretroviral drugs and other drugs and the excellent care that we actually do offer people inside and outside the U.S., he's still alive many, many years later, when in the old days, before these medicines and treatments, the second you found out you're HIV positive, you should be writing your will up in so many terms. So these medicines are quite useful and effective, but they have side effects. And it's not like, some do-gooder, recent graduate of Yale College, can get on a Delta Airlines flight out to Papua New Guinea and start handing out HIV/AIDS medicine in the jungle. I mean, that's not how it works. You have to read about it, and you really need a healthcare system in place filled with nurses and doctors and technicians and people to test this medicine. Now, one area, I'm the smallest possible government type of guy, but I will say that one valid area for government to pursue around the world is to hold these big pharmaceutical and medical companies in check and make sure that when a drug company sells you medicine, that drug company has made absolutely sure the medicine is in fact what it purports to be, and beyond that, to control the distribution of medicines. And when you do what Ira Magaziner and Bill Clinton appear to have done here, you create an off-the-books, unchecked, unregulated global mechanism to distribute drugs, not simply to the poorest countries in the world, but within those countries to the most difficult-to-get-to places in these countries that don't really have an infrastructure. When you do something like that, you are basically creating a gigantic opportunity for fraud, because you can say the medicine went to these places, and in reality, either distribute worthless drugs or turn around and then sell the drugs on the black market in places where there still is a stigma to having HIV/AIDS and where people don't necessarily go for the treatment they need and they're prepared to buy it on the black market. So, I mean, this is a very dangerous place in which to try to do business. And it's amazing to me that, around the world there are studies that show that a significant percentage, and I mean more than 1%, of all medicine is estimated to be counterfeit. I mean, that's shocking to me. Before we go and redesign the healthcare system in America or anywhere else, it seems to me that government at a minimum ought to ensure that there ought to be some mechanism to ensure that any medicine that makes it into the shelf and into a patient is actually what it says it must be. There must be a way of doing that. So it's shocking to me that the estimates are so high. It's shocking to me that Ira Magaziner and Bill Clinton and that the trustees, remember this foundation in theory had trustees, David Pryor, former senator, and I think the first dean of the somewhat strangely in hindsight named William J. Clinton School of Public Service, that he was a trustee, and the second dean, Skip Rutherford, I think, was a trustee. Vernon Jordan's wife was a trustee. Terry McAuliffe, the chairman of the Democrat Party in 2004 and current governor of Virginia, was a trustee. Didn't any of these people think to say, you know, actually, Bill, you know, Ira, you don't really have such a great reputation for running complex organizations well and failing to, you know, stay out of trouble. You really think it makes sense to, you know, start sourcing these drugs that haven't been approved by the FDA yet and distributing them in places like Mozambique and Papua New Guinea and the bush of Indonesia? We really think that's something that should be your first order of business, or maybe you should stick to like finishing the campus in Little Rock, which you haven't finished yet. And once you get that done, maybe we'll do something else. Why did nobody? And these aren't stupid people who are trustees. These are, you know, sensible people. Did they just take leave of their senses and say, well, you know, this is just Bill and Hillary's Chelsea's baby. They'll do what they want. We're just grateful for having our name on the front door. I mean, it's a shock to me. Under Arkansas law, there's a definition of care. There's what's called negligence and gross negligence. I would say this is, there's a book by this name, actually co-written by a friend of mine. This is reckless endangerment.
Well, it is also highly politicized, because all of the people that you talk about, this Ira Magaziner, who is the chief executive officer of the Clinton Health Access Initiative. This is the program that has proliferated in the so-called developing world. And the Clinton Foundation, which has no authority whatsoever to engage in buying or selling or distributing drugs and medications, but had managed, just the same, to corral all of these drug companies together. And I shared with you the tape yesterday of Bill Clinton announcing the triumphant accomplishment of bringing all of this to fruition. And so it would be the immediate benefit was to have people have access to these medications, although you did discuss that people right there standing right next to the president had to pay $500 million for essentially fraud producing medicines. So we have this constant theme of the Clintons popping up in places where you think, well, what are they doing here, and why them? I mean, why would it be that they have a kind of handle, they have a monopoly on these things? And on the flip side of that, the governments involved, the government of Papua New Guinea, the government of Malawi, the government of South Africa, the government of Haiti, they seem also not to be doing due diligence, because there is an automatic level of trust that, well, gee, this is the president of the United States, for crying out loud. How, we wouldn't dare suggest that he should be under suspicion, or his motives are suspicious, or this whole arrangement is suspicious. I find it hard to reconcile the way governments should be operating now to some degree, you know, a little bit of sophistication, knowing what they're dealing with, knowing that there are laws, their own laws that they ought to follow. But we seem to have acts of omission committed in massive amounts here, because you don't have that checks and balances system going on in the United States, where certainly by now the Clinton Foundation has been operating for quite a while now, and it has yet to come to the notice of the IRS that it is functioning way beyond what it's legally permitted to do. And it could be argued, because it's been dealing directly with the governments and governmental officials, the Clintons are in effect functioning as agents for foreign governments, which is absolutely not allowed. So what do you think accounts for the fact that they've gotten so much dispensation on both sides of the coin?
Well, you see, I think the way this has worked, there's a man I've come to know actually in connection with the work I did starting in 2007 on GE, a man called Jeff Gerth. And he's a very wise man who was for a long time a New York Times reporter, and then he exposed actually Whitewater. And I think he's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. So, you know, he's a serious fellow. He actually works now, I think, in league with the ProPublica which is a gigantic investigative news foundation that was created, I think back in 2006 or so, and has a slew of, you know, top tier talent with it. You know, he and others are very quick to point out that you don't really need too many people to game the system. And he recounts in his book, he wrote a book called Her Way about Hillary, a story about how supposedly Bill Clinton told, I think it was a biographer, about a plan they had, the 20-year plan, that first he would be president, then Hillary would be president, then they amended the plan, and then Chelsea would be president. And their idea would be that they'd insert their followers into government. And when you trace and you look at the various and sundry people who are hold levers of power, you know, who have the authority to either launch a prosecution or to stop a prosecution from going anywhere, many of these have ties even today to the Clinton machine. And they knew this. I mean, the Clintons have been operating. They operated from 93 to 2001. Most people don't really remember the history that Bill never got a majority of the popular vote. There was always Ross Perot in the mix. And yes, he won, but he did not win a commanding victory. And, you know, we don't need to go through all the various and sundry scandals, but there were a lot of them. And many of them involved helping out foreign donors, whether the Chinese, the Indonesians, others. There was an allegation, for example, that I think an Indonesian group got the benefit by creating one large thing of national park. We locked off the supply into the world market of a commodity that this Indonesian group, I believe, had a different competing amount of. So that by that act, that signature of the pen creating a national park, and I think against the objections of the governors at the time of the states affected, you know, Bill Clinton created enormous economic value for people. What about the Mark Rich pardon and other things like that? So people see all that, and they don't do anything about it because we now have in this country, we have a uniparty. We have people in the Democrat Party and the Republican Party who are quite content with a system where insiders, you know, get the winnings and the public just, you know, spends time playing around in ignorance. But I'm hoping, you know, and I really appreciate you, Treece, the chance to come on your show and share these views with your listeners. I see common ground developing between the Bernie supporters and, believe it or not, the people who are trying to shake off the Republican establishment and now, you know, in some cases grudgingly support Donald Trump. In both ends of the political spectrum in this country, I think people are sick and tired of the excuses. We know how tough it is to work. We know how tough it is to keep a job. We know how tough it is to pay mounting hospital bills and health care bills and food costs and car costs and rent. We know. And we are sick and tired, I think, on the right and the left. I'm speaking, I would place myself, you know, actually on the right economically, but on the left socially. So I don't know where that puts me. Maybe I'm just confused. But, you know, I look at this and I say, you know, When I hear that the Republicans and the Democrats got together and gave Jeff Immelt, this current CEO of General Electric, a company that I think is still being run into the ground, gave him the authority with Joe Biden to try to distribute almost $1 trillion in stimulus money, and then when it turned out after the fact that they created no jobs with almost $1 trillion borrowed U.S. dollars, placed now squarely on the backs of our children and our grandchildren, they laughed about it on television. You can see the clip for yourself. And we, the people, just said, that's okay. That's just the way Washington works. You know, it's a swamp. You know, what are we going to do about it? Well, you know, you go back to the very early days of this country. Now, our country, you know, I will debate happily anybody who wants to say that this country is exceptional, because when this country was created in 1776, we did not create freedom for everybody. But we created freedom for a lot of people. And back at that time, around the world, there was no comparable country. And, you know, the experiment went along, and it's had its ups and downs, it's had its problems. But we're a remarkable place. Well, what the founders relied upon in their construction of our government was that we would have citizen politicians. We would have people who did not just, you know, give to a political class the responsibility for our tear and feeding, which seems to be what Republicans and Democrats in the establishment of both parties wants us to settle for. No, they wanted people like you, Yatrice, like me and others, to, at a certain moment, you know, rise up and say, you know what, enough is enough with this political, and I won't be crass, but it has two initials and one of them is B. You know, enough of this. You know, we all in our daily life, we can't come home with children and say, you know, today I had hoped to get you a nice dinner, but today why don't we just read about what the Clintons are going to eat because we don't have any food. No, you've got to put food on the table. And, you know, this political class has not only has it not been putting food on Americans' table, it's crippling this country, spending trillions of dollars on crazy schemes. I mean, government money has gone to the Clinton Foundation, and there has not been U.S. government money has gone to the Clinton Foundation. There's never been a proper accounting for this money. Political contributors to the Clintons have gotten economic benefits. This is outrageous graft. This is Tammany Hall on a global scale in the 21st century. This is, you know, you take what Tammany Hall did here in just in New York politics, New York City and state politics, and think about it operating from New York City and Washington, D.C., all across this great planet. All this Clinton Foundation is nothing more than a gigantic, unregulated ATM. Favors, money goes in, and favors go out. And we're just sitting and taking it. And I look, you know, I'm going to be a little bit harsh here, but, you know, I look at my friends who were thinking about Hillary versus Bernie, and I look at the number of cases that happened during the election where it is alleged that shenanigans occurred in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, here in New York, in California, in certain states. And what do my friends who so passionately were in favor of Bernie Sanders, what are they doing about it? Absolutely nothing. All this stuff that we see about supposedly the chairman of the Democratic Party who, you know, was going to be, should have been impartial, but instead it turns out is now, you know, working like heck to get her friend Hillary Clinton elected. Why do people put up with this?
It's the question of the ages. I have no idea why it is that people are putting up with it. But there is some kind of movement in that direction. Although people would say, well, it's the Republicans and, you know, she's a Democrat, the Clintons are Democrats, so it's a very partisan issue. But there is a very strong moral, if you will, drive behind it. And it speaks to just what you laid out. People are offended. The Clintons have become so contemptuous and so convinced of their invincibility that they become more and more outrageous and careless and reckless in what they're doing, with the firm belief that nothing will happen to them. And this brings a question. You have a Democratic administration. Barack Obama was, in fact, a creature, if you will, a political creature of the Clintons. They backed him eventually, and he has not strayed too far away from the Clintons and even their programs, case in point being Obamacare, which was put together by Hillary Clinton, essentially, in private, with no input from Congress, with a bunch of insurance company executives in a closed room, and produced, and she just said, well, here's the template for health care in the United States. I can't help but think that the Obama administration is directly accountable here, because its Justice Department certainly has been alerted to the fact that there were questions about the Clinton Foundation and its operations, both in the United States and outside of it. On its own, it should have picked up that, you know, the news conference was public. I mean, how could a president publicly hold a news conference about what he's doing, almost, you know, as his own ambassador for his own private little country, taking initiatives that would send anybody in the world of diplomacy crazy, wondering whose permission did he get to do these things. So the question becomes, is the Clinton Foundation and are the Clintons receiving, in your view, protection of the Obama administration?
Well, you know, I'd be guessing. You know, I think there's been an interesting development in the last several hours where here in New York it's being reported that the Clinton Foundation is claiming, and I haven't confirmed this, but I've read the reports of the claim that they may have been hacked, and they're saying by the Russians, and that the information that may have come out of that hack could include forged versions of emails. And this story is being sold many different ways. Accompanying the story was the announcement, it seems, and again, I haven't confirmed it, that a woman by the name of Kathy Rumler, who was the White House, the second, third White House counsel for Obama. The first was somebody last name Craig, and then it was Bauer, and then it was Rumler. And when you look into Rumler's background, she's now a partner at the eminent law firm Latham & Watkins. She's a white-collar criminal expert. And there's a woman I've come to know named Sidney Powell, who wrote a great book called Above the Law that castigates Rumler. And apparently, you know, if you believe Sidney, and I do believe Sidney Powell, Rumler was, you know, basically brought up under disciplinary charges for the ways in which she went after people on the Enron desk. You could read Sidney Powell's book to see what I'm talking about. So, you know, it would seem as if, the wheels are beginning to turn and people are beginning to realize now, many months, as you and I, Beatrice, have been talking about this in the press, the Clinton Foundation has never come out and said, you know, here's our audit. Here's our legally compliant audit for every year. They've never answered any of these charges. When I went down to Washington, D.C. the last time, and I'm going to be returning shortly, when I went down, I was interviewed by a network who had gotten a whole bunch of my questions. And I was told, you know, before it was a film thing that I don't think has aired yet, I was told by the very nice and professional producer, oh, by the way, you know, all your questions, we ran it by the Clinton Foundation, and they told us that you're happy with their answers. Well, I've never spoken to the Clinton Foundation. I don't operate that way. You know, I'm a member of the public. They're not, on this radio broadcast, while we have this broadcast, they're soliciting money from the public based on their false and materially misleading public documents that they still haven't corrected. And, you know, I communicate with them publicly. And, I'm acting just like any other member of the public, although I might have a bit more training in how to analyze financial statements. And so with the president, you know, I would be guessing, but I'm prepared to guess. I mean, there are two versions of this memorandum of understanding that supposedly, in theory, was to regulate the Clinton Foundation and obviously didn't work because the Clinton Foundation has been operating completely out of control. One version, if you look carefully at it, is the first version that John Kerry provided to the world in connection with their confirmation hearing. That document has on the date of Valerie Jarrett's signature, it looks like it has a 2 overriding a 1 for December 16th, 2008. When you look at what I think, and I've talked to the people at Judicial Watch about it, they were given pursuant to, a Freedom of Information Act request, they got a copy of what they believe and tell me is the original MOU, and that one is very clearly dated November 16, 2008. Now, why would that be a material difference? One reason is that on around November 16th, and I don't have a calendar in front of me of 2008, but I think that might have been on the weekend, the final deadline for filling out New York tax forms on the Clinton Foundation, which they had to do and have to do because they operate in New York and had several offices in New York, was around that date. It might have been the 17th or so. So their filings were due. And actually, they were due August 15th, was the one extension you automatically get. And after that, you have to plead your case why you need more time. In my view, with these type of foundations, there's never a good reason to need more time. It means you're sloppy. It means your records aren't in good shape. Well, anyway, they didn't have their audit completed by that date. by the final filing date and ask me how you comply with the law. Yet, in the memorandum of understanding, which obviously, you know, had to have been negotiated maybe back and forth between Valerie Jarrett and the Clintons, you read it and it's as if, you know, it's a application for the Nobel Peace Prize, everything that they do. Fighting HIV/AIDS, this right, that right, all these things right. Hogwash. On that date, the HIV/AIDS operation of the Clinton Foundation had its license to operate involuntarily revoked in the key state of Massachusetts where its headquarters had been based. And that was a process that had been long simmering over many, many years. Many people had to know about that. But what did the Clintons do? No, they just kept running roughshod on it and made these representations to the Obama transition team, which Valerie Jarrett, you know, might have been able to check, but as a guest, she was probably a little busy at that moment. I mean, it was a historic moment, euphoria, a lot of hard work had gone into it. People were celebrating and looking ahead. Maybe they didn't do the type of homework, like the government of Papua New Guinea, like the government of Australia, that they should have done at that moment in time. So she signs this document on the 16th of November, 2008, which is hogwash. You know, my expert lawyers tell me that, first of all, no memorandum of understanding under U.S. law is going to be effective. It's just an agreement to agree. It's nothing more than that. It's not a binding document. And you look carefully, this, of course, is not a binding document. And you try to find Bill Clinton's name on it or Hillary's. It's not on there. What's the penalty for breaking the agreement? There's no penalty stated. What was the consideration? And, you know, it says in the document, this is the whole agreement. Well, you know, what if there's another agreement or a side letter or something else involved? There's no mechanism to check this. And the counterparty to the Clinton Foundation at that time, Bill was not a trustee, Hillary was not a trustee, Chelsea was not a trustee, nor were any of them executives or contractually bound, as far as I can tell. So how does this document regulate anything? And why would Barack Obama and Valerie Jarrett, I mean, they're not stupid people, why would they agree to such a document? And then you look a little bit further into the file in New York, which is available in the public domain if you Google New York State Charity Bureau search and look at the annual report for 2007, you'll see the correspondence back and forth. Looks to me as if Hillary Clinton and Team Clinton were jobbing Team Obama and jobbing her fellow senators and jobbing the people of this country, because the Clinton Foundation at that moment in time was basically bankrupt. It had lost its opportunity to authority to operate the biggest piece of its business. It was claiming it was fighting climate change. It had no authority to do that. It was claiming the convening center for the Clinton Global Initiative was validly constructed. It wasn't constructed properly. I could go on and on and on and on. But the simple fact is it didn't have an audit done. And then on the 15th of December 2008, as Hillary's trying to schedule her appearance before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee over her Secretary of State appointment, they have an agent send a letter into her state, the state she represents, saying, by the way, we're sending you everything that's required, except our accountants need more time to complete the audit. They say this, and an agent says this on the 15th of December 2008. Now, of course, they select a firm that is not qualified in New York, so doesn't know New York law, doesn't know that that letter is a complete fraud. No, on December 15th, you cannot send in everything that was due because the final deadline was November 15th. And no, the auditors didn't need any more time. As you look in the record, you'll see very clearly the audit was completed on the 12th of December 2008. So either this agent did investigate the truth, just took the excuse given to them by somebody, or they actually knowingly misled the regulators of the state that Hillary was serving at a time when she was trying to get authority from her colleagues in the Senate to become our Secretary of State. I mean, think of the number of people and the record that must be there. And then think of the reaction that you would have if you're Valerie Jarrett and Barack Obama. We remember the history. You know, the relations were not all that friendly prior to June 2008. I mean, there were moments where, as the English like to say, the Team Obama got rather cheesed off at the Clinton, with some of the remarks that Bill made about Barack. And, you know, these are just human beings. And, you know, here now Barack and Valerie are, you know, basically controlling the United States government. January 20th, 2009 forward. It takes a few weeks or days to get your people into the IRS and into justice. And, you know, somebody probably said, you know, we better check this Clinton Foundation and just let's just make sure. Let's see what the file looks like. After all, this was a time when people were complaining about excesses of foundations. The Tea Party group certainly got investigated. People knew how to check the rules, and lo and behold, the person who now represents the Clinton Foundation, Kathy Rundler, was very much in her role as White House counsel, somebody who was called out at the time, I believe, by Lanny Davis for the improper way in which she failed to inform the president of excesses taken by the IRS and others against Tea Party groups. So this is somebody who knew the rules about foundations. And, you know, you're telling me there are no emails anywhere from anybody concerning, you know, Valerie Jarrett and other people saying, wait a minute, you know, we need to reorganize this thing. Wait a minute, this thing is not authorized to fight HIV. Well, how do we do that? Well, we could try this way. What about that way? There's no emails concerning the reorganization of the Clinton Foundation that have been released to date, and supposedly all work-related emails have been turned over. You know, anybody who believes that all work-related emails and the missing ones are yoga and wedding celebrations, you know, is living in a dream world.
Well, it's a kind of contempt that the Clintons historically have had for the public. I understand that there were several requests by the feds to the Justice Department to initiate probes into the Clinton Foundation, and they mysteriously were blocked. And, of course, it had to be the case that orders came from on high, from the very place where the president lives, to basically just cancel that. Do not look at the Clintons right now. He is on the road with her, for crying out loud. He has come out and endorsed her. And I would assume that his afterlife, they have somehow discussed what he's going to do in his afterlife. And in some ways, the Clintons provided a template for that. So I don't know to what degree they have kissed and made up to the point where they see that they have more interests in common than not. But in any event, it appears that the White House itself has been blocking any probe of the Clintons.
Well, that'd be very regrettable. I mean, I think, you know, in this case, Barack and Michelle Obama have actually given more than $200,000 out of their Nobel Peace Prize winning in 2010, I guess it was, to the Clinton-Bush Haiti exercise. And so, you know, they've given money, and if this thing is revealed to be what I believe it is, a fraud, normally the IRS would go after them. And they'd say, you know, you took a tax deduction for this $200,000, give us $100,000 plus, you know, whatever the penalties and interest are. So there is a clear conflict of interest involving Barack and Michelle Obama and this foundation. That's one thing. You're right, absolutely right, to say that, you know, Barack Obama and his team are well advanced in plans to raise, I believe it's $500 million to build this massive compound out in Chicago. And, you know, quite frankly, I think it's a great thing. I mean, Mr. Obama, I disagree on many, many things, many policies of his, but I think it's a remarkable thing that, you know, he came to be the first African-American president of this great country. I think that's wonderful, and there ought to be a presidential library to really study his time in office, what he accomplished, what he failed to accomplish, what is, you know, his whole life. He's a historical figure for the ages, and so we ought to do that. But the foundation needs to be run in conformity with U.S. and state and foreign laws. And, you know, perhaps this is a great opportunity to expose the Clinton Foundation and then regulate the Obama Foundation so that it doesn't do what Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton have tried to do and have gotten away with low these many years.
And even the so-called liberal media, they're asking questions like, well, if Hillary were to be elected, should she then basically have nothing to do with the Clinton Foundation? They're not asking the questions, what should be done about the Clinton Foundation now, and they're not exposing the criminalities of the Clinton Foundation as it operates. But they're now talking about, well, you know, theoretically, should she give up her affiliation with the Clinton Foundation when she becomes president? I find it really remarkable that they're staring a problem right in the face. It is screaming for investigation and attention, but they're not interested in asking those questions at all. But I'm thankful that you are, and that you have been doing this work and meticulously researching all these aspects that we've been talking about. So we have been the beneficiaries of your very hard work. And I hope, for all kinds of reasons, that something comes of this, because it's just so wrong on so many levels that this is going on. And when you mentioned that you're really talking here roughly about $100 billion, at a time when people are losing their jobs, having difficulty meeting their daily needs and so forth, and the level of just, how could I say, heartlessness, that people could be so stupid that they would find themselves in such a situation, when look at us, we're making a ton of money. It is really contemptuous of the American public, and I think I thank you very much for the work that you've been doing and for making yourself as available as you have been here on Lead Stories. Thanks so much.
It is my great pleasure, Yatrice. Always a pleasure. I look forward to tomorrow, and I'm happy to answer questions for as long as you'd like.
Right.
And I encourage people to reach out to me through my site and on Twitter.
Great. It's CharlesOrtel, ORTEL.com. Tomorrow, we will take only questions tomorrow on what we've been discussing all week and the Clinton Foundation. Your chance to talk directly to Charles Ortel and ask your question then. So that's tomorrow's plan. Thanks again for joining me today and for giving us these incredible insights into the functioning of a rather hard to understand subject. Thanks so much, Charles, for being with us today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.